From listener-supported Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, we remember the Loma Prieta earthquake that shook Northern California 20 years ago tomorrow and killed dozens. Also, a very current play called Speech and Debate about high school students and social media. But first, these are challenging times for many people, perhaps particularly for some parents. With young kids to support, they might face special financial and emotional pressures. A conference tomorrow in Sacramento County aims to help. It's called Caring for Children in Stressful Times, and it has speakers on such topics as fighting fatigue, weathering the financial storm, and managing stress. Three of the other speakers join us in our studio. You're going to meet them, and we will start with Judy Ishura, who's Infant Toddler Specialist Coordinator with WestEd's Program for Infant Toddler Care, Partners for Quality in Sacramento. Judy, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's a long title, but you basically help people work with their children, their young children.
Exactly. WestEd is an agency, and we provide on-site training, coaching, and mentoring for teachers, family child care providers, or administrators working with children birth to 3 years of age.
Now, your session at the conference tomorrow is called Managing Anger, Modeling Alternatives. Is anger a common problem with parents with young children, very young children?
Well, I think anger is an emotion. So just like laughing or joy or excitement. So absolutely, it's on the spectrum. So the session tomorrow is really going to help whether they're parents or teachers look at how stress can affect you. And if it is anger, we're going to kind of give you some strategies that you may use for reflection or self-awareness to really put yourself in a better position to deal with it.
What can provoke anger in a parent of a young child at a stressful time?
Oh, I think there's lots of things that the parents fatigued. I mean, look at the financial pressures that both parents and teachers have right now. It could be emotional stress. It could be physical stress. There's lots of different elements.
You said that you're going to give people strategies, and I guess that's what the modeling alternatives part of the title of your session deals with. What does that mean, modeling alternatives?
Basically, one of the strategies I'm going to kind of walk through folks for tomorrow is called the MBCs. It's basically noticing, breathing, and then coping. And so what I'll do with folks is have them, through self-awareness and reflection, think about what happens to them when they become stressed or angry. So they'll kind of notice whether they're physical or emotional, what changes they make, and then we'll give them some breathing strategies that they can do, and then also what will they do to cope. And so we're hoping that kind of through the self-awareness that we can help them develop anger management plans or kind of self-reflection plans, so that when they get in that moment where they feel angry or they feel high stress, they kind of have some strategies that they know will work for them.
Well, it's a cute title there, NBCs, noticing, breathing, coping. Is that a lot of work to learn that and to put it into practice?
I don't think so. I think it's really noticing that self-awareness. What happens to you when you get stressed? Does your heart accelerate? Do you start to yell? Do you get quiet? What happens to you both physically and emotionally? So we'll kind of guide them through that self-awareness piece. And then the breathing is just like all of us take three deep breaths when start to get stressed. And that even kind of starts help to regulate a little bit.
Just three breaths?
Just three deep breaths at the beginning, just to kind of help you take a pause before you might react.
And then coping, I guess that's the thing that's the lifelong issue, isn't it? Because noticing
Absolutely.
And breathing you can do relatively quickly once you know how to do them.
Absolutely. So, and that's where it's really going to be individualized. So coping, does a person want to take a walk? My thing is pulling weeds. I love to pull weeds, and that's a great coping strategy that helps me deal with some stress. So we'll give them lots of different alternatives, and then they'll individualize to what will work best for them.
Judy Ishura of WestEd. She's an infant toddler specialist coordinator. She's one of the speakers at tomorrow's Caring for Children in Stressful Times conference. It's a day-long event, starts tomorrow at 8 at American River College. Her session's called Managing Anger, Modeling Alternatives. On a related issue is the session Children and Stress. And giving that session is Molly Archbold. She's training specialist for Prevent Child Abuse California. Molly, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me today.
Children and stress. Whose stress? Is that the parents or the children's?
It's both. So how an entire family can be affected by stress, and how the parent's stress can then be relayed onto the children, and how children then develop differently and grow up differently because of that stress.
How do you mean the children can develop differently? What might happen?
So brain development specifically is what we're going to be talking about, and how a child's environment actually wires the brain to develop in the way that it's going to then live in the world. And a brain will set itself up for the world that it's in. So if it's growing up in a very stressful environment, it will wire itself to work and thrive in a stressful environment. Whereas if it's raised in a nurturing, loving environment, it will actually wire itself to thrive in a nurturing environment.
Well, what can happen as that child whose brain is wired for a stressful environment grows up?
Well, a stressful environment can be a lot of things. So there's minor. We're actually going to talk about different levels of stress. But toxic stress, which is the highest level, is going to actually rewire the brain so that the child has to survive. They're basically, we try to think about primitive times and the way the brain will actually go back to those primitive times and think about survival, and aggression works well in survival times, and a lot of different coping skills that work best when they're in that primitive state versus that, you know, thriving, happy, loving state.
Well, I guess that stressful situation in prehistoric times was the fear that a saber-toothed tiger
That's
was
exactly
just outside
right.
your cave. There might not be a saber-toothed tiger
No.
outside the cave today, but I guess that vigor stress Mm-hmm. of living in tough economic times can have the same impact.
That's exactly right. Whether it's a scary parent or a scary neighbor, maybe it's a community thing, can still affect the brain to actually need to respond in those same ways.
But if the situation in your life is just inherently stressful, the kids' parents are maybe unemployed, they don't know if they can keep the house, the neighborhood's not so good, all that kind of stuff, much of that you can't do much about on a daily basis or even for an extended period.
Right.
What can you do about that stressful environment mm-hmm. that can help not wire the kid's brain?
So that's where the importance of working with parents comes in, because the way parents cope with those stressful times is the way children will learn to cope. So if parents are screaming and yelling at each other and really upset all the time and aren't paying attention to the children, that's the way that their brain's going to develop. Whereas if they're in an environment where the parents are learning to cope with their stress, so when they're, you know, really upset about money problems or whatever it may be, they're modeling, talking it through, reflecting and thinking about it, sharing with the children what they're stressed about and really talking through it, then those children are going to learn how to think through things rather than to become really angry and throw things and those things.
But we talked about how the brain of the child can be wired because of the stressful situation, and then that can lead to problems when they're older. Do the parents' brains also become rewired if they're living in a temporarily stressful situation?
Not necessarily. Brain development, everything has a window of opportunity that can change, but mostly it's when they're young. So a parent can change when they're an adult, but their brain doesn't necessarily completely rewire itself the way a baby's brain is literally a giant sponge and is soaking up everything in its environment, and whereas a parent is mostly already developed.
That's Molly Archbold. She's with Prevent Child Abuse California. My guests are all speakers at tomorrow's one-day conference at American River College, Caring for Children in Stressful Times. The third speaker with us is Kimberly Morales. She's author of the blog Poor Girl Eats Well, which focuses on eating well on a very small budget. And her session is called Poor Girl Eats Well, Tips and Strategies for Stretching Your Food Budget. Kimberly, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me today.
Do you actually have to stretch your own food budget?
Absolutely. Everything I write about on my blog is from personal experience. I've been broke a little bit longer than the recession's been around. So I have actually been able to share a lot of my own tips with people who are having a hard time figuring out what to do
Have you had to change the way you shop for food and cook food since your financial circumstances changed for the worse?
Definitely shopping has changed for me. I'm naturally a very impulsive buyer. So, you know, I see a wonderful deal on like brie and I will put it in my cart even if I don't need the brie cheese. So I've had to really rein my impulses in. Definitely start off with a really tight budget. On my blog, I do a feature called the $25 shopping cart, where I do have to force myself to stick to those $25 and have enough food to last me for a couple weeks. So the shopping has changed a lot more than the cooking has.
How do you suggest people change their shopping habits if they don't have so much money anymore?
Definitely let go of some of the shame that's associated with a lot of shopping.
How do you mean?
Brand name shopping isn't really it's not the end of the world if you buy store brand. It's really not. And you're going to save, you know, anywhere I've seen between the 5 and 10% on the same item. It's just a difference in packaging. It's marketing and things like that. So trying to let go of also the shame of not being able to have the same, you know, fancy wine that you used to, you know, stepping down a little bit, but realizing that it's still okay and you can still have quality meals and quality time with your family because of those meals that you'll be making together.
What about farmers markets? Are they a good deal or not if you're shopping on a tight budget?
For the most part, yes. Some things are a little bit more expensive than you would find at a regular grocery store. But for the most part, to get the best produce, I highly recommend going to farmers markets. You'll find fantastic deals and the quality is going to be much better. And, you know, especially since this conference is dealing with how to care for children, I'm sure a lot of parents are concerned in having, you know, a lot better quality produce and just more nutritious meals for their kids.
Kimberly Morales is author of the blog Poor Girl Eats Well. I was looking at your blog this morning and your latest posting. It looks like an absolutely delicious gourmet meal, and I feel hungry looking at it because it's one of my favorite things. Spiced pear bread pudding with red wine glaze. That doesn't sound like a poor girl dish.
It actually can be. I just, I'm good at naming things and making them sound fancier than they actually are. But that's almost another way that I employ to do the whole eating well thing. It's more of a mentality thing where, sure, I'd love to go to a restaurant, but, you know, if I'm creating this little dish and I can add something like a red wine glaze to it, I feel a little bit more like I'm with the rest of the world, you know, considering that I'm not and I can't go out as much as I used to. The recipe itself, I believe it's only about $1 a serving, perhaps.
Wow.
All I did was use bread that, honestly...
95, I'm just looking it up, 95 cents per serving. That's crazy.
I just used bread that I knew was going to go stale, and, you know, you need stale bread to make bread pudding in the first place. Couple eggs, some milk, and some spices, and I happened to have one pear, and I was like, ooh, that'll be a nice addition.
And there must be a sense of satisfaction and pleasure in making a beautiful meal for almost no money.
Oh, it's wonderful. I mean, I think to myself, gosh, restaurants are going to hate me the more people find out about my blog. They'll kind of start hating me for recreating a lot of dishes.
Yes. And Molly Archbold, I guess shopping well, eating well, probably helps stress.
Absolutely. I don't really know what else to say about that. But, you know, when you're eating well, that just encourages family time, being together, not to mention the fact that nutrition is good for the child's brain as well.
Yes. Very good. Well, thank you all. My guests are three of the speakers at tomorrow's conference, Caring for Children in Stressful Times. It's an all-day event, starts at 8 at American River College in Sacramento County. Kimberly Morales is author of the blog Poor Girl Eats Well. She's going to be talking about stretching your food budget. Molly Archbold is with Prevent Child Abuse California. Her session is called Children and Stress. And Judy Ishura is with West Ed. And her session is called Managing Anger, Modeling Alternatives. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from listener-supported Capital Public Radio. Coming up, we remember the Loma Prieta earthquake that shook Northern California 20 years ago tomorrow. You're listening to Insight from listener-supported Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. 20 years ago tomorrow at 5:04 p.m., a big earthquake rocked Northern California. As it happens, that moment was caught on national TV because the San Francisco Giants and the Oakland A's were playing in the World Series. Tim McCarver and Al Michaels hosted the pregame show from Candlestick Park.
Candy Maldonado with the hesitation, allowing Jose Canseco to score, and he fails to get Dave Parker at second base, so the Oakland A's
I don't know if we're on the air or not, and I'm not sure I care at the moment, but we are.
When the Loma Prieta earthquake was done, 63 people were dead, several thousand injured, and thousands more unable to live in their homes. We're going to recall the earthquake with two people who lived at the time within a few miles of the epicenter in the Santa Cruz Mountains. They're both regular voices on Capital Public Radio News, Capital reporter Steve Shadley, and arts critic Jeff Hudson. Steve, Jeff, welcome.
Good to be here.
Steve, let's start with you. Where were you when the earthquake happened, and did you realize that it was an earthquake?
Well, it's kind of funny. I, like a lot of people, rushed home from work that day. I was working in public radio in Santa Cruz to see the World Series on TV. And I got home, and I flipped on the TV. And just as I arrived home and unlocked the door, my cat zipped right out the front door. And he was usually a lazy, kind of lethargic animal, so I thought, something's up here. So I flipped on the TV, and I went into the bathroom, and I was actually standing at the toilet when the quake hit. And it got very eerily quiet for a moment, and then the whole house jerked. And it was very violent for a few seconds. It stopped, and then it started again, and then it stopped. And I just remember the mirror in my bathroom fell very slowly to the floor. It was just kind of a creaking eek. And I thought, wow, I wonder if this was a bad quake. And I noticed the ceiling in my living room had caved in. So it was a really kind of an interesting, fun experience, but it was also very traumatic.
Jeff Hudson, where were you?
I was at the newspaper office in Watsonville, and I knew it was an earthquake, and I started moving toward the exit. And then the big S wave kicked in, and the overhead fluorescents started ripping loose from the ceiling, and the desk drawers on the metal desks slid all the way out, and the center of gravity shifted, and the desks started tipping over. And I began to realize, I may not get out of this building, which was a very sobering thought, let me tell you.
Yes. Now, you were in Watsonville, which is, I think, about 10 miles from the epicenter.
Seven
miles from the epicenter. Tell us what happened in Watsonville. Did people die there? Was there a lot of destruction in the small city of Watsonville?
Well, I was one of those thousands of people who was put out of the house by the earthquake, actually. About 10% of the housing in Watsonville was ultimately found to have been damaged to the point that it wasn't safe to live in. Immediately after the earthquake, you know, people in Watsonville were looking around, and there was one fatality, and we were listening to the radio. Nobody had a TV because there was no electricity, but battery-powered radios were working, and we heard about the freeway collapse up in San Francisco, and initially they thought there were hundreds of people dead into that freeway collapse. As it turned out, there were a lot fewer than they thought because they were all home watching the baseball game. But at the same time, as the earthquake inspectors moved through Watsonville, they found, wow, this house is off its foundations. It can't be lived in. Wow, this one too. And so within a day, there were thousands of people camped out in the city parks and no place to go, and water trucks bringing in water so that people had water to drink. And Watsonville, on a per capita basis, actually got hit probably harder than any place else.
Steve, you were in Santa Cruz. How was Santa Cruz affected?
I lived fairly close to downtown, right close to Santa Cruz High School, and right by Pacific Garden Mall, which was especially hard hit at the time. And I walked downtown right after the quake hit, and I noticed a lot of buildings, a lot of these older brick buildings, were just piles of debris. And I would say about 6 to 10 people died in downtown Santa Cruz that day, Bookshop Santa Cruz and a coffee house there. It was pretty bad.
As it happens, I lived in Santa Cruz at the time, too. And for me, one of the most salient memories was the helicopters in the sky, because I realized that I'd never been in a place before where helicopters were coming in to help people, to evacuate, to bring in supplies and so on. And Steve, you wrote about that in an online forum. Tell us about that memory for you.
Right after the quake, Jeffrey, I went outside and my neighbor came over and said,
we have to turn off the gas because you could smell natural gas everywhere. And so we turned off the gas, and just like you say, within a half an hour, 20 minutes right after the quake struck, it was amazing to see all of these news helicopters from the Bay Area, from different parts of Central California coast, and also some emergency evac helicopters. But you're right, it was almost like a war zone or something. Very surreal.
Jeff Hudson, you sent us some photographs of the historic house where you were living at the time, and we're posting some of them on our website. One that really stood out for me was the sight of this large brick chimney lying on the ground.
Yeah, that was one of the chimneys that came down. On the block that I lived in there, I think there were 27 chimneys that came down all at once. And of course, this will happen in parts of the Bay Area if they ever have a similar sized earthquake in the East Bay, as they think could happen. There will be so many chimneys down, you'll just have to take a number and wait for somebody to come do the job. It was an amazing experience. The winter that followed the earthquake, the sight of a house up on blocks getting new foundations poured was so common we didn't even look at it anymore. I mean, it was just like, oh, another one.
Steve Shadley, what about your home?
My home I was renting at the time, it was an older, probably built in 1885, one of those downtown, very elegant Victorian-style homes that lived on the ground floor. And my ceiling, not the roof, but the ceiling of my apartment caved in, and they had a lot of plaster and that lattice woodwork from those days. And it was funny, they had mixed some sand. It appeared to be from the beach, because the beach, I was very close to the boardwalk there. And a lot of that gritty sand, to this day, Jeffrey, I still find it in my record jackets and some of my books that I've kept since then. So it's a reminder for me that that quake happened 20 years ago.
Another eerie thing that happened in Santa Cruz at that time was how was something that happened with the main clock at the top of the Pacific Garden Mall. Steve Shadley, tell us about that.
Yeah, that's another thing that stands out to me is the hands on this old clock stuck right at 5:04 p.m. the moment the quake hit, and they were that way for months to come. And it's just sort of a symbolic memory for me.
Steve, you were working, as you said, at the NPR station in Santa Cruz, KUSP. You were news director and you were the morning edition host, but you weren't able to do much reporting.
No. We were knocked off the air, including our backup system. There were some problems with our transmitter. The transmitter was located in the Santa Cruz Mountains. And so we were off the air for about a week or so. And I was gathering tape, and I was helping NPR in their coverage. But a lot of it was just phone work. But the station itself wasn't on the air for another week or so. And then we had a series of sort of town hall meetings informing people who were trying to pick up the pieces as to where they could go to get help and services.
And Jeff Hudson, you were working at the Watsonville paper, the Register Pajaronian. How did they handle the disaster?
We actually published the day after the earthquake. We had one reporter who drove down to San Luis Obispo, which was a sister paper at that time. We had one phone line open, and we had old Radio Shack laptop computers, TRS-80s, those of you who are old enough to remember them. We were transmitting stories one at a time to San Luis Obispo. They printed the paper there. They put it on an airplane, flew it back to Watsonville, landed at the Watsonville airport. They had to land before dark because there were no lights at the airport, so they could only land by daylight. And so as twilight fell in Watsonville on the day after the earthquake, we actually had a print edition of the Watsonville Register Pajaronian being delivered to people's homes. It was amazing. I can't believe we did it.
We're remembering the Loma Prieta earthquake, which happened 20 years ago tomorrow at 5:04 p.m. My guests are two regular voices in Capital Public Radio News, both of whom happened to live in Santa Cruz County at that time, Capital reporter Steve Shadley and arts critic Jeff Hudson. Steve, it took Santa Cruz a long time to recover from the Loma Prieta earthquake. Tell us what things were like downtown.
Well, I've been back many times since the quake hit 20 years ago. And, you know, for about a year or two, Jeffrey, you may remember, Bookshop Santa Cruz was in a tent. It was still in the same location. They
yes.
leveled the building, and there was a tent there for about a year or so. But I think they're still picking up the pieces to this day. It was just, it's a very long, evolving process to recover from something so devastating.
Jeff, what about Watsonville? Very different town. Santa Cruz is a beach community, a university town. There's quite a lot of poverty there, but there's also quite a lot of money there. Watsonville is more of a blue-collar community.
Downtown Watsonville really never came back after the earthquake. There were a lot of old brick buildings from turn of the century through the 1920s that were damaged, and a lot of them never really came back. If you go through that part of downtown Watsonville now, you'll still see some vacant lots and things like that.
Yeah. And finally, Steve Shadley, have you been in any other earthquakes since then? And whether you have or not, do you recall how you felt at that moment?
Yeah, actually, I have been in some small little tumblers in California here and northern Nevada since then. And you kind of get that uneasy feeling in your stomach, oh, no, it's happening all over again. But these are kind of the roly-poly quakes that don't do a lot of damage. But it does spark a weird, strange sensation in me.
Yeah. And Jeff Hudson?
When I'm shopping over in Woodland at JCPenney's store, they have a big air conditioner that when it starts makes a big loud bang noise. And I must confess, I get a little jumpy when I'm buying shirts at JCPenney's and that happens.
Very good. Well, thank you both so much. In our studio, Capital Public Radio arts critic Jeff Hudson, and on the phone, our Capital reporter Steve Shadley, both of whom were in Santa Cruz County at the time of the Loma Prieta earthquake. It happened 20 years ago tomorrow. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to Insight from listener-supported Capital Public Radio. Coming up, a very current play called Speech and Debate about young people and social media. You're listening to Insight from listener-supported Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Monday on Insight, journalist Mark Hertzgard. He writes about climate change for magazines like Vanity Fair, The Nation, and Time. Also, we'll talk with the author of the new book, The Prohibition Hangover. It's about what happened to Americans' drinking habits after the repeal of Prohibition. And Bat Boy. It's a musical with a rock band, and it's about a strange creature found in a cave that's encouraged to act like a normal boy, but the local townspeople turn on him. Back to today, Speech and Debate is a very current play running in Sacramento. It's about young people involved in a scandal at their school, and their use of social media is an important part of the story. The play is produced by Capital Stage. Two cast members join us. We'll get to them in a moment, but we'll start with the play's director, Stephanie Goulart. She's also the producing artistic director of Capital Stage. Stephanie, welcome back.
Hi, thank you very much.
Speech and Debate, why is it called that?
Well, it has a couple of different meanings, but literally there is an attempt by one of the students to form a speech and debate club. Ultimately, three students at the school come together, and they all have very distinct and different motivations for joining the speech and debate club. But all of them have something that they all have voices that they're trying to find a means to have heard. And the speech and debate club becomes that medium for them.
Anything else you'd like to tell us about the story overall?
Well, it's a story that's a little difficult to describe because it's so fresh and new, and really I think represents our culture today. And it was one of those plays that when I read it, it made me kind of sit up. Because it doesn't follow a prescribed structure. It continually surprises. It's a really fresh perspective, and our audiences are walking away really delighted. It's full of a lot of humor, but also it's a very distinct experience.
We're talking about Speech and Debate. It's running through November 8th on the Delta King in Old Sacramento. It's produced by Capital Stage. As I said, two of the cast members are with us. They're Lindsay Carter and Benjamin Ismail. Lindsay, Benjamin, welcome to Insight.
Hey, thank you.
Lindsay, tell us who you play.
I play Dewata. She is...
Dewata.
Yes, sir. She's a 17-year-old girl who tries very, very hard to get cast. She's a performer at heart. She's an entertainer. And, you know, through all her attempts, she comes up short every time.
Is that because she's not very good, or is there some other
reason? You know, I think she's, you know, she's got her strong points, but I think maybe she pushes a little too hard and kind of turns the drama teacher off to her. So through her own devices, she finds a way to get out there and be seen. So
and Benjamin, who do you play? And tell us a bit about him.
I play Howie. Howie is 18. He's a senior that's kind of a transplant student. He moved right before his senior year to this town in Salem, Oregon, where these other guys live. And kind of an outcast by his own device, I guess you could say. He's the only member of the show that's like an out and proud gay character, and he's been so since he was a kid, and he's sweet in his own little not sweet way.
Is that significant to the story that he's out and proud and gay, or is that just one of those just
the,
happens to
the
be?
Show deals a lot with sexual identity, just as kind of on top of the, you mentioned there's a scandal along with it. But yeah, it's crucial to the show that I think that he's gay. I think so.
Stephanie, why is it set in Salem, Oregon?
Well,
as opposed to Salem, Massachusetts.
There's kind of a play on the Arthur Miller's The Crucible, which our beloved Dewata is dying to be cast one day as as Mary Warren in The Crucible. She feels she was born to play Mary Warren, and through a strong oversight by the drama teacher, did not failed to be cast in that role. And so she has written a musical entitled Crucible. the musical.
And, with an exclamation point.
And it's one of the highlights of the play when you get to see some of DeWada's interpretations. But so I think that there's a little bit of, with some of the sexual politics and some of the scandals that are underlying the themes of the play, the idea of the Salem witch trials are kind of, it's kind of a play on that. And I think that that's why the playwright very consciously set it in Salem, Oregon.
Yeah, because Salem, Massachusetts, that would be banging people over the head.
It would be, and let's have a little subtlety. Yeah.
Lindsay and Benjamin are going to do a scene for us from the show, Speech and Debate. Stephanie, do you want to set it up for us? Tell us what our listeners need to know.
Sure. Well, the kids, the three main characters in the play actually all meet online. They find each other through DeWada's podcast and her blog. And through the podcast, they discover that they have something in common, a scandal in common. And so this particular scene, DeWada and Howie are meeting for the first time in person to discuss their the common information that they have.
I see.
DeWada's at work.
Sounds like an important point in the play. We're going to listen to a scene now from Speech and Debate at Capitol Stage. Let's hear it.
Look, if Solomon opens his mouth and I'm known as the pervert cruising for online sex, you think I'm going to get a gay-straight alliance started?
People have their own secrets.
No, people care. That's why being in Salem is so... Look, I hate that straight fraternity dudes can have their porn and Howard Stern can talk about doing all these women and it's just normal straight guys. But if there was a gay Howard Stern...
I like Howard Stern.
That's not what I'm saying.
Look, what does this have to do with Solomon? You're out, you're proud, you can do whatever you want. More than most minorities, what? More than women.
No way.
Stop whining.
No way.
Yes. Homophobia is so 1985. Most people think it's cool.
It's not cool. It's not trendy. It's biology.
Shh. I'm just saying. Spill your coffee or something. Help me look busy.
What?
Do it.
Jesus.
People our age don't have these hang-ups. By the time we're adults, these won't even be issues. And I didn't mean for you to spill the whole cup, damn it.
Do you really think people would think awful things about me if they saw that transcript?
I'm a double minority.
What? What are you talking about?
I'm just saying, if you want to whine about being gay, I'm just
whining.
Saying, I'm female and Filipino.
You don't look Filipino.
You don't look gay. Yes, you do.
It's the hair, right? Is it the hair?
Yes, blonde boy. And P.S., what shade of blonde are you, Ebony?
Shut up. The name gets guys' attention, and I bleached my hair last summer, so...
My grandmother was half Filipino. I'm an eighth. That means my kids someday will be a 16th. Is that how that works? You just keep dividing?
I guess so. But what do you mean someday? From your podcast, it sounds like you're...
That I'm what?
Expecting or...
Expecting what?
Aren't you...
Hungry?
DeWada.
I'm not pregnant.
Oh, in your podcast, it sounds
like... I'm not pregnant. I was drunk if I said anything.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I work at Januzzi's, that pizza place near...
Yeah, I know where it is.
Near the Family Planning Center. Saw you go in there last week.
No, it wasn't me.
You had your uniform on, which is kind of memorable. Anyway, how classic is it that in a Salem strip mall you can get an abortion and a slice of pepperoni pizza in one shot, you know? I'm sorry if it was a secret or something.
Yeah, it is. I just wanted to be there for my friend, just FYI. I wanted to be there for her.
Oh.
But I could see how you would think that.
Yeah, because you went in by yourself.
I was late. I'll be right back with some fries, sir.
What?
My goodness. That's an excerpt from Speech and Debate. You heard Lindsay Carter, who plays DeWada, and Benjamin Ismail, who plays Howie. And Stephanie Gillard is the production's director. Stephanie, it's intense dialogue and great performances.
They're a terrific cast. I've been really, really lucky. And they really capture the complexities of the age that they're playing, that kind of borderland between adulthood, adolescence and adulthood. And there's a ton of humor in it that comes out of the affection, I think, that the playwright has for the situations that the characters are in. Even though there's a lot of intense, serious issues at play, there's a lot of humor that comes out of it.
Stephanie, is it a challenge casting actors to play high school students? Because I'm guessing... Lindsay and Benjamin are older than high school, but they look and sound convincing.
I think our whole cast looks, they look the ages that they're playing, but they're a little older. And yeah, it was a challenge because you want that authenticity of the youth that is, you know, so much what's going on thematically is about, you know, being at this age. At the same time, I think that one, just in terms of acting skill, you want some experience to be able to really convey what these characters are going through. And two, and Ben actually said this during rehearsals, and I think it's a good point, that you kind of can understand a lot of the complexities and understand the age better when you're a little bit past it. And you can look back on it and reflect on it. You actually can kind of understand where you were at and what you were going through a little bit better than when you're right in the middle of it. So we have a cast that does bring an authentic youthfulness to the play, but they are a little bit older than the characters they play.
Ben, I see that you're from Memphis originally.
Yes, I am.
Where do you live now?
I live in Natomas now, but yeah, from Memphis.
How long have you been in this area?
I've been in Sacramento for about a year and a half now, I guess.
Oh, I see. So yeah. Were you in Memphis the rest of the time?
No, I lived in Boston before Sacramento.
Wow, you've been around.
Yeah, I have. And then at college in Arkansas. Yeah, so I've been all over.
Well traveled. Yeah. Lindsay, what about you?
I'm originally from North Carolina. After college, I came out to Sacramento, and I was here for, I think, like 2.5 years maybe. And then I went to L.A. for a little while, and then I went home for, I think, a couple of months. And now I'm back, so I'm here.
Stephanie, the play seems so current because of the use of the social media. How long ago was it actually written?
It was first produced about 2 years ago at the Roundabout in New York, and is really just catching fire now, and it's kind of starting to pop up all over the place. We're doing the Northern California premiere at Capitol Stage, but it's... was written 2 years ago, but is really kind of hitting the mainstream theater track now.
It would be very easy to use stuff like social media as a gimmick in a play just to attract attention. Were you concerned about that when you heard that it was part of the play?
In terms of
yes,
utilizing
if you'd heard about it beforehand. Yeah.
Well, I think that I don't think we were concerned about it as a gimmick. We wanted to figure out a way to bring the technology into the live theater setting because it is so much about being in a technologically driven world and how that affects the way people communicate with each other. And, you know, at the real heart of the play, I think that it's ultimately about connecting and loneliness. And I find, really this compelling idea and reality that the more and more we become connected through technology, the more this kind of epidemic of loneliness is prevailing. And I think that's very much what these three characters are experiencing at the beginning of the play. So we did want to introduce some sense of the technology into the play because it is so important. So you will see the characters with their laptops and a projected chat dialogue actually starts the play off, which is required. It is a part of the script. And it's kind of done as a set to music and so the technology I think is really important to it, but you wouldn't experience it the same way if you were watching it in a movie. It's really works for live theater.
Lindsay, do you have any further thoughts based on what Stephanie was talking about there about the connected but lonely and the use of the technology?
I think she's dead on. I think technology is huge, especially in today's youth. Like, for instance, I asked my niece, who's 14, if she passes notes in class and all that stuff. And she was like, no, we text. So they text during class. And whereas we used to actually like write out notes. But yeah, the video, the podcast blogs and stuff, totally like the norm, I think, with today's youth and stuff like that. So it's very relevant.
Well, Ben, you said that you're of the passing notes generation.
Yeah.
But do you use social media much yourself?
Oh, yeah. Now I do, for sure. And I love that the play does that because my character doesn't even speak until the fourth scene. Everything I do is through media and texting and IMs and all this kind of stuff. But yeah, totally. I use it all the time. I'm on, you know, Facebook and all that crap.
Stephanie, who's the playwright?
Stephen Karam, and he is actually in the process of actually writing a screenplay of Speech and Debate. They're anticipating it being kind of a Juno-esque, type of independent film for young people and young adults. And he, I think, has a very promising career ahead of him.
And finally, Stephanie, just briefly, How's Capital Stage doing? It's been a tough year or so for a lot of nonprofits and performing arts groups. How are you doing?
Thank you for asking. We are, this show, Speech and Debate, is the first show of our fifth season. And it was actually 1 year ago when everything kind of seemed like it was going to come to a permanent halt. When the real bad economy news hit, we certainly felt it. And so we're doing a lot of reflecting right now. Okay, we've made it through. We made it through the last year, and I think we've made it through the toughest, knock on wood, the toughest part of what's gone on. And
have you changed the plays that you're presenting because
we're,
of it?
We've become a little more streamlined. All of our shows are small casts. But we're staying true to our mission to do entertaining, thought-provoking pieces, and primarily pieces that are new to the region, plays that Sacramento hasn't had the opportunity to see here at the professional level yet. So we're really sticking to our guns. Our audiences were really clear with us last year that that's what they want. That's why they come to Capital Stage, and that's why they'll continue to come to Capital Stage. So we're going to keep giving them that.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you. Speech and Debate.
Presented by Capital Stage. It runs through November 8th on the Delta King in Old Sacramento. Stephanie Gillard is the director of the production, and she's also the producing artistic director of Capital Stage. And two of the cast members joined us, Lindsay Carter, who plays Diwata, and Benjamin Ismail, who plays Howie. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison.